Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Memorative Forum and the chair of this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Daphne Miller. Daphne Miller, MD, is a practicing physician, author, and professor of family medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. For the past decade, her writing and teaching has explored the frontier between biomedicine and the natural world. Her widely acclaimed first book, The Jungle Effect, chronicles her nutrition adventures as she travels to traditional communities around the globe. A contributing columnist to the Washington Post, as well as to other newspapers and magazines, Miller holds a medical degree from Harvard University and an undergraduate degree from Brown University. She lives in gardens in Berkeley, California, with the architect Ross Levy, their two teenagers, a dog and a cat. Dr. Miller.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Bill, for that introduction. It was lovely. I'm so honored that you're all here this evening, especially given that we have an Academy Award winner in the next room, Rita Moreno. And I happen to think she's quite a star. But this evening, I'm actually going to start by telling you about someone else who, in my book, is pretty much a superstar. And that's a gentleman named Ron Finley. Has anybody in this room heard of Ron? Well, you will soon. He's got his TED Talk that he did a couple months ago has like 1.5 million views already and over 1,000 comments. And Ron lives in South Central Los Angeles. He's sort of born and bred South Central LA. And he just got sick and tired of seeing all of the diseases in his community that were related to not having access to good, fresh, healthy food. The diabetes, the hypertension, the heart disease, and the obesity. So he got together with his friends, and he actually started to plant what he called food deserts. And in this TED Talk, he talks about how he, as a renegade gardener, starts to convert all the median strips and just those little parking strips and empty lots of South Central Los Angeles. And at one point in his talk, Ron makes this statement. He says, to change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. Wow. That's actually a really profound statement. And I haven't met Ron yet, although I hope to soon. But I can pretty much guess what he meant by that. And what Ron was really talking about, my guess, is that, in fact, he's talking about the idea of biodiversity. Now, this is a word that we hear bannered around all the time. We're sort of comfortable with it at this point. We know it might mean something healthy. But many of us haven't given it a good deal of thought, and certainly not a good deal of thought in terms of how it relates to our physical health. But I think that what Ron was saying is that when you have a rich, diverse soil, what you're going to create is rich or vitamin-rich food. But on a macro level, if you have a rich, diverse soil, in fact, you're going to create a healthy community. Even if you haven't eaten the plants that necessarily grew from that soil. That it is this health benefit from biodiversity that's happening on many different levels. Now, my personal education in biodiversity started when I began to visit family farms. And it was really starting to intuit this connection in health between diverse ecosystems, this connection between diverse ecosystems and health that made me even want to leave my medical office and start to go out and visit farmers. But as I did this, it became a real exploration and a real lesson in biodiversity. And the first part of that lesson started with this couple, Eric and Wendy Hawkinson, who own a farm called Jubilee, which is in Carnation, Washington. Now, Eric Hawkinson bought his farm in the early 90s, and his goal was to grow fruits and vegetables with nutritional punch. He wanted to feed his community in a healthy way. But as he started to work his soil, he realized that what he was producing was a little tired looking, that his soil, in fact, was depleted and tired. So he went to the agronomy textbooks to try and figure out how he could replenish his soil and grow better fruits and vegetables. And what he started to do was something called test and replace, where you basically go around and you take little soil samples from different parts of your land and put them in a test tube, and you send them off to the lab, and then the lab actually sends you a lab report. This is my photograph of the lab report that looks very much like the kind of lab report you would get from your doctor, and it tells you what the soil is deficient in, which minerals it's lacking. And then you go and you buy those minerals from a company, and you put them in your soil, test and replace. So Eric started to do this, and this, by the way, is perfectly compatible with organic farming, test and replace, because his goal was to have an organic farm. And he noticed that things were getting a little better, but really not the beautiful fruits and vegetables that he was aspiring for, or the vibrant, healthy soil that was filled with microbes and fungi and, you know, all the healthiness that he was expecting to see there. So he went back and did more research. And this time, instead of going to the standard agronomy textbooks, he started to read writings from the grandmothers and grandfathers of organic farming, the great early thinkers in organic farming, like Sir Albert Howard and Rudolf Steiner and Lady Balfour, and even more recent ones like Wendell Berry. And he also started to read a lot of the more progressive agronomy research that was looking at biodynamic and organic farming. And what he realized was that, in fact, what he needed to do was power the subsystems in his soil in order to get a rich soil. He needed to power all those invisible, unpaid workers who were the ones who were taking the organic matter and converting it and feeding it, packaging it into perfect doses of nutrients and feeding it to the plants. And this was all the bacteria and fungi in the soil and all those nematodes and so on. So following the advice of these organic writings, Eric started to farm in what was more of a regenerative model, where really what you're doing when you're doing regenerative farming is you're farming in the image of nature. You're doing what nature does naturally when she farms. How does nature farm? Well, first of all, she always farms with animals. They're part of the natural cycle. They're there to process plant matter and put the nutrients back into the soil. Nature always keeps the ground covered. She conserves water. She always has a diversity of plants, and they come from seeds that work within that context. She doesn't use a lot of external inputs, be they pesticides or fertilizers. And so this was the model that he started to adopt. And as he did, he noticed that his soil began to flourish and his plants began to flourish. And in fact, he sent soil back to that same lab after not having bought inputs for a long time and realized that the numbers he was getting were even better. So listening to Eric's story as I was spending time interning on his land and picking his fruits and vegetables with nutritional punch, I thought to myself, you know, this story, this test and replace story, this is something that marches out all the time in my practice. Skip over that. This is something I see all the time in my own office. And I see it in with my patients who come in when they're feeling a little bit off. And what do they ask for? they ask to be tested. And sometimes we find things that are really off, and even times where a medication is going to really make an enormous difference, or a supplement. But most of the time, what we find are things that are out of balance. But still, what we do is we replace a little thyroid here, a little vitamin D there, a little multivitamin there, and so on and so forth. And this is really how we do it in medicine. It's very much of a reductionist approach, the idea that, in fact, we are test tubes and that we can put a variety of things in there and they kind of find their own place and heal whatever they're supposed to heal. And if we put an extra dose of D or E or something, so be it. It will come out the back end. And what we're starting to discover is that probably much of the time this doesn't do terribly good, but actually there are some times where it seems to be doing quite a bit of harm, both in terms of pharmaceutical interactions, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but we're discovering that even those supplements, those nutraceuticals at high doses can be problematic. They gave beta-carotene in the hopes of preventing cancer. And what they found specifically for people at high risk for lung cancer was that it increased their risk of lung cancer. The same thing with prostate cancer. I'm sure recently you've been following the controversy with calcium and heart disease. And it seems like all this mega supplementation that we're doing might in fact be harmful. So realizing that test and replace in my patients was not exactly getting me where I wanted to be, the next question I asked myself as I was sitting there on Eric's farm was, what happens if I put my patients into his web of life that he has on that farm, that wonderful regenerative cycle that he has created? What happens to their health? The answer to that, as it turns out, comes back to this one word. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about why biodiversity is indeed teaching us that these patients, like his land, like Eric's land, tend to thrive when they enter these cycles. Well, first of all, as Eric taught me, we're learning more and more about the fact that when you have a healthy, diverse soil with lots of fungi and nematodes and bacteria, that in fact translates into fruits and vegetables that are higher in nutrient value. And this does not necessarily mean organic translates into fruits and vegetables with higher nutrient value. But when you farm in this regenerative way, the way that nature farms, the research is showing that it's really quite promising. And that we're starting to see that, in fact, when you have this diverse soil management, you have microbial diversity, and that there is a direct connection between microbial diversity and plant nutrient diversity. It marches out. So we know biodiversity in the soil translates into real nutrient diversity. But then, and here actually, I just gave you a picture for you to see visually what that looks like. This is two different plots that were studied. And one of them is a organic but ecologically farmed soil, and the other one is a conventional soil. Can you guess which is which? The one on the left or the right is ecologically farmed. The one on the left, yeah. It's really quite remarkable. This is the same seed, two test plots that are right next to each other. And one of them, they really did try and farm in the image of nature. And the other one, it was, using a lot of inputs. And also using pesticides and herbicides and so on. So, it would be interesting to have a third picture there that was organic, so that you have the ecological, just straight organic, but the way that Eric was trying to farm originally, and then conventional. That would be very interesting. But when they take that, this is a wheat plot. When they take that wheat and they test it, they actually find that it's much higher in certain nutrients as well. The wheat that is ecologically farmed. So this is the second farmer who taught me some important lessons on biodiversity. And he actually taught me about the connection between biodiversity and a healthy immune system as being another important connection between this idea of diversity and health. This is Cody Holmes, and he's a farmer in Missouri, and he's a beef farmer. And Cody got tired of all the inputs that he was putting into his beef cattle. He got tired of it both for health reasons. He realized that what he was doing was saving one of his cows aside each time they would go to inject them or treat them with hormones, and that was the cow that he was feeding to his children. And he also got tired of this doing the system economically. He realized that he was constantly in the red because he was, in essence, spending all this money on inputs to buy the feed for his cattle, to buy the pesticides that he was using in his land, to buy the hormones that he was injecting into his cattle, and he wasn't able to make a living at it. So he quit doing everything. He quit putting everything into his land and into his cows. And what happened was this prompted a whole series of other changes. All of a sudden, he needed to start to graze his cows in a different way. So he started to mob graze them so that it would give time for the grass and the soil to regenerate between feedings. He stopped weaning his calves because he was no longer buying the supplements that he would need to feed them. And as a result of that, his grass started to thrive. He started to realize that his pasture was becoming much more diverse. And once again, those microbes in the soil were becoming much more diverse. And Cody is not a scientist. He's a farmer, but he's a very wise farmer. And he told me that one of the biggest things that he noticed from this was that his calves and his cows were no longer getting sick. They weren't getting a lot of the respiratory illnesses and a lot of the other chronic diseases that you see in cows who are either in the confined systems or agriculture or who are receiving a lot of the chemical inputs. And he told me, he said, it is the biodiversity of these microbes that is in some way making my cows healthier. Well, it turns out that this woman, who is a scientist, her name is Erica von Mutius, and she's an MD, PhD, and she runs the Center for Allergy and Immunology in Munich, Germany. And she has been saying the same thing as Cody. And in fact, she's been going out there and researching what's going on these ecological farms and finding out that, in fact, it is the biodiversity. It's the way that these children are exposed on these farms to the raw milk that you see over there on the left, to the dust in the cow sheds, to the animals that they're, you know, literally being raised with, to the other members of their family because they're in their big family. It's this exposure to all these microbes that early on is priming their immune system so that it doesn't overreact when it sees something later on, and is in fact creating a healthy immune system. And when you look at what's happening worldwide, what we're seeing is that we're losing our biodiversity, and this is on a number of different scales that they've used, we're actually seeing this increase in allergic diseases that goes in perfect lockstep, but in the opposite direction. So this loss of biodiversity translating into a less balanced and less healthy immune response. And this is exactly what Cody was seeing in his cattle, and he didn't necessarily have the science to explain it to me, but Erica von Mutius did. This is another researcher. His name is Justin Sonnenberg, and he's a little closer to home. He is at Stanford, and he and Erica Sonnenberg have both been researching this fascinating idea that somehow our exposures in our environment, be they from DNA or for other bacterial exposures, somehow are interacting with, in fact, all those bacteria that exist within us and are there as sort of our guardian bacteria, what you're all hearing about, the microbiome, which doesn't just exist in our gut, by the way. It exists in our respiratory linings. It exists on our skin. It exists in so many parts of our body. It exists in our ears. And what Erica and Justin are studying is this interaction between all the bacteria in the environment, the bacteria in our gut, and our own DNA, our own cells, and how this is affecting our health. This is what I call interplanetary communication. And it turns out, once again, with this, that biodiversity plays a huge role. So this is one study that Justin did not do himself, but he reported on. It was actually done by researchers, French researchers. And what they did was that they located a certain enzyme which exists in a bacteria which lives in the ocean and digests seaweed. So this is a bacteria which loves seaweed, thrives on seaweed, thanks to this enzyme. And with PCR, they were able to go and figure out where else in the world this same sequence of enzyme exists. And in fact, they found it in the microbiome of cultures that eat a lot of seaweed. And what had happened was that over generations, there had been a game of swap the gene, where basically this bacteria that lives in the gut had probably passed that sequence of DNA on to, maybe it was hitchhiking on the seaweed. You eat the seaweed, and then what happens is that sequence of DNA started to transform the microbiome. And what it did was give cultures like people in Japan more of an ability to digest seaweed than someone who comes from an inland nation, let's say, like my ancestors. This is probably just the tip of the iceberg. There's probably this kind of swap going on all the time between us and our environments and the food that is grown in that environment. And it is probably having all kinds of impacts on our health. And we're just starting to figure out this game of swap the gene. But as you can imagine, the more biodiverse what you're eating is, and the more biodiverse the environment that that food comes from, the more information that you're getting. And what we're finding is that when environments, in fact, become less biodiverse, like when they're treated with more pesticides and so on, that what tends to survive are kind of the bad bugs. And they, in turn, start to pass their information on to our gut. And that is some research that was recently published in Science. So biodiversity sort of leads to more a multitude of information that's more delicate but more beneficial to our health. This is one more story I'm going to tell you about in the bacteria land. And this is another one that Justin Sonnenberg introduced me to. But these are Italian researchers who went and actually collected feces from healthy young children in two communities, one living in Florence and another one living in Burkina Faso in a tiny, tiny agricultural village called Bulpan. Now, in Bulpan, they eat in very much from an eco-cycle, the way that we saw in Eric's farm. They don't have money for all the inputs, and they really are farming in very much of a regenerative way, and that's the food that they're getting. And kids in Florence these days are basically eating like kids in the States. They're getting a lot of fast food, a lot of sort of high sugar, high fat in their diet. And when they looked at the bacterial populations in these two groups of children, what they found was that in the kids in Florence, they had more bacteria from the phyla of Firmicutes in their stool. And these are kind of tough bacteria that are really good at harvesting nutrients from carbohydrates and fats and passing them on to their hosts. And that was really the predominance of what they had, those reds and pinks that you're seeing over there on the left. And then when they went to Bull Pond, they actually found that those children had more of the Bacteroidetes, which are the same kind of bacteria that was on the seaweed, that's really good at digesting vegetable matter and grains. But that was only one part of the surprise. These Bull Pond children, they were eating more from a regenerative cycle. They were also eating more greens and grains. They had more of these bacteria that are good at helping them to digest those nutrients. But the Bull Pond children also had bacteria that you can't even culture or find or harvest from the gut of more Western children. These are also from the Bacteroidetes group and seem like they are also good at helping our microbiome succeed with these healthy foods. But what's happening is that they're becoming extinct. As the biodiversity in the soil and the biodiversity in the way that we produce our fruits and vegetables and manage our land is disappearing, we are losing our microbiome, or very important parts of our microbiome. And one of the ones they found was that Xanilobacter, which is on the right, which actually made up 20% of the population that they found. I'm going to tell you, we're switching to another farm now, and this is even closer to home. This is Sonoma, California, and this is a farmer named Andrew Mariani, and he owns a farm called Scribe Winery. And spending time with Andrew and also his consultant, who's an agronomist, Jeff Wheeler, I learned about the connection between biodiversity and maintaining a healthy dynamic balance in our cells and in our body. So Andrew's story is really interesting. When he took over Scribe, he was really troubled by all the rattlesnakes that were there on his property. And he went around, he started killing them because he just planted all these baby little grapevines and he wanted them to succeed. And he somehow felt that, you know, having these rattlesnakes there was gonna, you know, destroy his land, make his farm workers not want to come there, who knows, you know. So he started killing rattlesnakes. Next thing you know, the grapevines started to disappear. They were literally disappearing underground because the rattlesnakes were eating the voles that were the ones who were, in fact, destroying his grapevines. And the minute that he started killing the rattlesnakes, he really had a problem. And this was an epiphany for him very early on, and he realized that the way he wanted to farm was much more in a balanced way, in a balanced ecology. So he got some really smart agronomy consultants to come on, and what they basically did was they created a healthy insectiary on his land where everything was in balance. And this is my silly drawing to illustrate it. But, like, for example, he had a problem with spider mites. So what they realized was that raspberry leaves and raspberry trees were going to encourage lace wings, which would, in fact, attack the spider mites and counterbalance them. He was having a problem with the gophers, so, you know, the rattlesnakes were part of the solution, but he also put in owl boxes, and the owl boxes were there to counterbalance the gophers. He was having problems with vine rot, so he brought in sheep who were there to eat the weeds so that there wasn't as much, you know, of wetness during the winter, and he could have less vine rot. In the summer, in fact, the weeds pull the wetness from the vines. And he started to plant a whole diversity of plantings from milkweed and so on to deal with other, that would attract other beneficials and deal with other problems like leaf rollers. So it ended up being this very balanced ecology. And interestingly enough, another scientist, and this guy's name is Bob Gattenby, and he's in Tampa, Florida. He's at Moffitt Cancer Center. he became really interested in this insectiary way of farming with all of these biodiverse elements on the farm. Which, and by the way, this is called integrated pest management for those of you who are in agriculture. He decided, Gattenby decided, that in fact, integrated pest management had a lot to teach him about preventing and treating cancer. And he started to think that in fact, when we have a pest in a field that's overwhelming the field and taking over, that it's very much what happens with cancer. It's a lack of biodiversity. And that oftentimes when we try and solve a cancer with one chemotherapy or one type of radiation, what do you get? It might work for a little while, but especially if it's a more advanced cancer, what you get is resistance because those cells are smart. And they evolve, and they evolve to overcome that treatment. And that marches out when we look at our national rates or our rates of curing so many types of metastatic cancer. We really haven't gotten much better than we were 50 years ago. And Gattenby started to think, what happens if we started to take a more ecological approach, where we actually support the healthy things, the beneficials, rather than just trying to attack the one problem. And where we don't just use one pesticide or one chemotherapy, but really start to think of a more balanced way within the field of dealing with this. And so he has started to do some really fascinating research with this. And this is just to show you sort of what his thinking, and that what he's trying to do is really look at all the cells, those multicolored cells that are around the cancer versus the really non-biodiverse, the lack of biodiversity in the cancer, and start to really promote their activity so that they can actually counterbalance the cancer cells. And in many cases, keep it from advancing. Very much the idea within integrated pest management. And this is a shift. It's a shift from conquering or eradicating to balance and actually sort of more maintaining. But it's interesting stuff, and it's actually starting to march out in some of his studies. Now, this is just a projection on some of the research that he's doing now, and most of his research is just incredibly experimental and new. He just got one of the promising investigator awards from NIH, so this is very new, and no one should change their cancer treatments based on this at all. But what he has found is that in the first, you know, couple years or so, and even up to about 10 years of a more serious cancer, a more advanced cancer, that if you pound it with chemotherapy or you treat it by encouraging the beneficials, you kind of get the same outcome. But as you start to move out 20 years and 30 years, you start to realize that if you encourage the beneficials and then do some treatment, which is the bar far over to the right, you actually are getting a lot more survival than those bars on the left, which are just sort of traditional pound it with chemotherapy. And so, and this is starting to, you know, mostly with rodent studies, but he's managing to keep these rats who otherwise would have succumbed to melanoma or colon cancer within weeks or months, he's managing to keep them alive indefinitely with this integrated cancer management approach. Very much this idea of maintaining the biodiversity of our healthy cells to push back the less healthy ones. This is a farm in Arkansas that it is an egg farm, and it actually taught me about the connections between biodiversity and stress. This is actually two farms folded into one. The farm on the left, they're both owned by the same farmer. The farm on the left, those bunkers that you see, those concrete bunkers, they each have 15,000 hens in them. And there is a little patch of land between them. Can you see it? That's the free range part. Because these hens are free range organic. they are given organic mash. So when you buy the eggs in the store that say free-range organic, that's their house. Over on the right there, see that big field? That's the pastured hens that this farmer, much like Eric, has moved to for both ethical and financial reasons. These hens are $5,000 to a house, and they're the ones that you're paying $8 a dozen for at that top shelf at Whole Foods, and you just can't believe that people reach up there and do that. But those eggs, as it turns out, are higher in a lot of fat-soluble nutrients, A, D, E. They're also higher in omega-3 fats. The shells are sturdier, so they don't break. And the hens themselves are much healthier. They lay for longer. They have much fewer health problems. And this kind of gives you the scene from the inside. That's me pretending to be a hen on the right. In fact, the one on the left, I need to tell you, is not from those bunkers, although it looks exactly like what goes on in those bunkers, because I was not allowed to photograph within the bunkers. For certain reasons, I was not allowed to bring my camera in there. So I stole that one from the internet. But it looked exactly like where I was. The one on the right is indeed the pasture farm that I was on. Now, if you think that those hens on the left are the only ones experiencing stress and the ones on the right have a stress-free existence, then in fact you're wrong. They just have different kinds of stress. And it turns out that that difference has everything to do with the fact that they are healthier and that their eggs are healthier. The ones on the left, you can imagine what that stress is like. It's low grade and chronic. Your neighbor is always in your face. There's feathers flying. It's hot. You can't find the door to go outside. It's noisy. There's no place to roost. There's no place to do your chicken behaviors. The one on the right, you can dust bathe. You're in the sun. You can chase each other. You still have the tip of your beak, which is actually taken off on the left, so you don't peck each other to death. So you could actually get pecked by an alpha hen. But that's a hen activity. But the stressors are there, too. I am thinking that's a stress to get pecked by an alpha hen. But there's other stressors as well. I mean, you can get attacked by a hawk. You can get pelted by hail. You can get, a wildcat can come over the fence and get you. And so they have their moments of nervousness. But the ones on the right, in fact, have this real diversity in their existence. They have tons of options and opportunity and fun throughout their day. And even when the stressors come, they're different, and they come and they go. You know, it's a lot of variability that goes on. The ones on the left, it's like, a flat line every day, just total monotony. And this is Bruce McEwen, who's really a guru on stress. He's at Rockefeller University in New York. And in fact, he studied stress in chickens and humans. So he was a great person for me to spend time with. And he said that this difference between that sort of low grade, day in, day out, not a lot of options, your boss constantly picking on you, no windows in your office, can't bring your lunch to work, can't exercise at noontime, versus on the other side, having occasionally like heart pumping things that go on, like you have to get up in front of a group and give a talk, or there's other things that happened for you, but at the same time, lots of choice and lots of community. Because in fact, it turns out when you're not so crowded in, you can make more personal connections. That is the difference between healthy stress and unhealthy stress. And that's why we care about reaching to that top shelf if we can, because encouraging that kind of diversity in the experience of the animals, that kind of diversity also marches on into the nutrients that we are receiving. So, once again, an interesting lesson. This is a aromatic herb farmer in Washington State whose name is Annie Harmon. And she actually brought me inside the plants and taught me how diversity inside the plants was also so important to us. I went up there because I wanted to learn about the healing power of plants. And she really is this green witch. She understands chemistry, and she also understands more of the energetics of plants. And she distills them and makes these hydrosols out of them. And there's some of her fresh chamomile over there on the right. And I kept on asking her, what's the active ingredient in this plant that allows people to sleep? Or what's the active ingredient in this plant that's going to make my skin nice? Or the active ingredient in this plant that will help with our digestion? And she kept on saying to me, Daphne, stop pharmaceuticalizing these plants. She said, just take valerian root, which is, have any of you ever used valerian for sleep? Yes. There's at least 16 different chemicals that we've isolated from valerian that might contribute to its calming or sleep-giving effect. But the problem with all these chemicals is that they're in tiny, tiny doses. And the theory that chemists have, or biochemists have, is that for some reason that it causes a GABA-type effect. But in fact, GABA doesn't even cross the blood-brain barrier into our brain. So even if, you know, there were GABA effects in here, how is it actually making us calm? It turns out that we cannot explain this. There is some kind of synergy that's going on within all the parts of this plant and probably many other parts that we haven't been able to draw little chemical configurations for, which are what give it its calming and sleep-giving effects. And this, for me, was so important, too, to be able to, you know, move into these foods that we eat and these plants that we get and understand that we can't be looking for that super element or that super ingredient that we somehow can get removed by a chemist and given to us as a supplement. Annie taught me a lesson on biodiversity on a whole other level. And I don't know if you see all those little names up there, but those are all farmers who are growing the herbs that she is distilling in her big still. And they're peppered all over the northern part of Washington State. And I realized that this health of our system is an economic one as well. We need that biodiversity of the small farmers who then band together and they sell through Annie and are able to actually sell through big distributors. But she sort of taught me one on the most macro level, on the most micro level, her lessons. And my final lesson came from this woman, Karen Washington, who taught me an amazing lesson on biodiversity. And what she taught me is that in order to have a healthy community, in fact, that community needs a lot of different kinds of resources that do the same thing. And that urban farming is a way, a means of giving a community these resources. And that was a huge epiphany for me because I had really only thought of urban farming before Karen as a way of giving nutrients to a community, as a way of giving better choices for food. And if I had heard Ron Finley talk before I'd met Karen, that would have been what I thought he said when he was talking about, you know, you've got to change the constituents of the soil in order to make a healthier community. But in fact, that is one piece of it. But there are so many parts of this healthy soil and this biodiverse soil that makes for a healthy community. Mrs. Butler gives a great example of that. She's one of the farmers in La Familia Verde, which is this farming collaborative that Karen Washington's a part of in the Bronx. And she's in her 80s, and it really wouldn't matter if she was farming tulips or tomatoes, because what she is doing is she is out there every day and moving her body and connecting with her neighbors. And research is showing that these kinds of activities actually keep seniors more spry and healthy, and are also decreasing the rates of advancing on to dementia. That in fact, urban gardening and all the pieces of it are anti-dementia medication. And Kevin, who's Karen's cousin, taught me that this same consortium in the Bronx, the same group of community farms, was a way for him to become an entrepreneur. So here's another resource for a way that urban farming is helping. And he was starting to bake using goods from the farms and sell them in the community. And Omar, who's a pre-med student at NYU, taught me that he grew up in this community and was inspired by, you know, what he saw there in terms of the health-giving effects of these gardens and wanted to work in public health. So another way that they had inspired health in their community. And Victoria Cabrera, who was saving seeds from her community and bringing them back and also saving recipes. So increasing, literally increasing the biodiversity of these community plots by saving seeds from all over the place, including her native Honduras, and bringing them back to be farmed in the Bronx. And Heidi, who runs the community center there, is actually taking all the food from these gardens and using it in the teen programs and the after-school programs. And so they have this whole, you know, healthy program for teens and an anti-obesity program. And this is PS 58, who are not only coming to the farmers market that's run by this group of community farms, but they're about to go into the park behind the farmers market, which used to be a hotbed for crime. And when these community gardens started and they started to bring the farmers market to the front of the park, guess what happened? The drug dealers decided that this was not their home anymore and they went somewhere else. And it is a beautiful park for the community. So here we have urban gardening sending people off to medical school. We have it creating these spry, healthy seniors. We have it creating food. We have it decreasing crime rates. Amazing. So once again, as Karen was explaining to me, you need this diversity within a community to have a healthy community. And this is Jill Litt. She's a PhD researcher in Colorado who's actually studying this. So I think you kind of have an answer now when thinking both about what Ron Finley was saying, his statement about how you have to change the constituents of the soil to have a healthy community, and also about thinking what would happen to my patients if I put them in these healthy cycles. What are all the different ways that they would get healthy? So in closing, I'd like for you to turn this a little bit towards yourselves and think of this idea of biodiversity and how it relates to you privately. Think about it in your daily patterns, kind of like those chickens, you know. Are they diverse or is it more like that barn, you know? Think about it in terms of your sleep patterns. Are they healthy and getting up in the morning, having real sleep-wake cycles? Think about it in terms of the food that you're putting in yourself. Both, does it come, is it diverse in itself? Because we know that just eating, having a very diverse diet is so good for you, but also where it's coming from and who's farming it and what's the soil like that's making it. And also all those pseudicals that we're so into in our culture, both the nutraceuticals and pharmaceuticals and recreational pseudicals. How are they impacting your biodiversity? So often I see patients who take, you know, high doses of stimulants to be able to focus, but then they mortgage their sleep. Or other patients who are doing all these chemicals to their body to have a baby, but they mortgage their health in the long run. And these are things that I really think that we need to, you know, start to think about. Think about your relationships, like what we saw in the Bronx. Is there a multiplicity of them, and are they all supporting each other? Is there diversity in the relationships and your sense of purpose? And probably most importantly, in your environment, are you close to green spaces, and what are those green spaces like? Do you have options in the day in terms of how you spend your day? Do you have options for getting to work in case the bridge closes? Do you have options for energy, from the way that you get energy for your home? These are all parts of biodiversity that we need to think about. And if you don't still don't somehow think that the lessons from a farm pertain to you, then look at this. In fact, when you squint, we kind of look like soil. Or again, here, this is our intestine. We look like soil. And if you look on a micro level, we really look like soil. This is our intestine and then what's going on in the soil. And that makes sense, right? Because all of those proteins and fats and carbohydrates in plants, they get passed on to animals, including us. So, in fact, we are soil. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just a reminder to our listening audience that we're listening to Dr. Daphne Miller speak about her book, Pharmacology. And now we're open for questions, and I'll pass the microphone around.
Actually, what I'm finding myself concerned about, not personally, but I hear it with other people, is somebody has some illness, and they go to the doctor, and he gives them some sort of a drug. And he says, okay, with this drug, you can't eat this and this and this and this. So I'm thinking, how is this person going to really get well when their body is having to deal with the drug and then not getting the nutrients? So where are the doctors? How can we get the doctors on board here?
That's a lovely question. I can't answer the specific without knowing what the drug is that you're talking about, but what I find is happening is that it's not a we, you know, us versus them situation. And that more and more biomedicine is getting very interested in these issues. That graph that I showed you of sinking biodiversity and increasing allergic diseases was one of the most accessed journal articles this year. It was amazing. I mean, I couldn't even believe how many hits had gotten, and it was, you know, within PubMed, so, you know, by people in the science world. That being said, you know, we're at the beginning of a new wave, and these things are slowly starting to make their way out there. But I've been asked in October to go speak at Yale University and do grand rounds on biodiversity and health. The Department of Psychiatry, in fact, asked me to come. They're very interested. And I find within the medical community, there is really starting to be a real interest in starting to look at these issues in a more interdisciplinary and macro way. So I'm hopeful, and I feel like, you know, I'd like to think that maybe pharmacology has played a little role in that. And yes.
The incidence of resistance to gluten foods appears to be increasing. Is that because of the soil that the food is grown in? And as you've said, one person eating food grown in this soil, their chemical makeup, their cellular makeup would react to it while somebody sits at the desk.
Right. I think that the answer to your question, and you are correct, we are seeing an increase in a lot of different allergic diseases. Gluten allergy is just, it's an allergy. And it's for the same reasons that I explained, that when we don't have biodiversity in our food, and we are just exposed to certain antigens, which are proteins, over and over again, without a lot of chance to be exposed to many different proteins, we tend, you know, to develop more allergy. And that compounded with the fact that we have these hyper-responsive immune systems because we, you know, so it's a lack of diversity in our food and a lack of biodiversity in our own, you know, immune priming that has caused this.
Hi. How do you apply the biodiversity theories that you have in your own life? In simple terms, what do you eat and where do you buy it?
So that's a fair question. And it is something that I really do spend a lot of time thinking about. My husband's in the second to last row there, and he's laughing because he has to bear the brunt of my concern with these issues in terms of our family life. But I am very interested in trying to, as much as possible, foster a local agriculture that works, you know, with farmers who work in your region and who I know what their principles are. I know the way that they are treating their soil. And so it really is, you know, knowing your farmer. I'm also really interested in gardening myself and, you know, the challenges and the successes that go along with that. But I'm not an absolutist. I very much believe that, you know, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, and I try and think, you know, outside the box and have bad meals occasionally. and, you know, I don't get so worked up when my kids bring home those packages of donuts from 7-Eleven anymore. I think that there you need to have resistance to that stuff too, so that's part of a biodiverse diet. But I try and really think of balance in the day in terms of those issues that I raised, in terms of thinking about being challenged on a number of different levels, doing things that are physically challenging as well. I dance, although I'm a hopeless dancer, because it really hurts my brain. So I try and put myself in front of a group of other people and move my body. I have solar panels on my house because I really am interested in this idea of diverse energy sources, and my husband's is an eco-architect, so he forces those issues. So really in terms of my social connections as well, I feel like being intergenerational and multicultural in your approach to life is very, very important. When we get caught in our box, we really, literally, that kind of uniformity, that loss of biodiversity is not good for your outlook on life. And I don't know if you guys noticed those pictures from the Bronx, the different ages, the different ethnicities, that's what goes on there. And that really is like the key to the health of that community and why it's starting to do quite well, you know, within that farming network. So.
Thanks for the talk. Wonderful. And I agree completely with the last statement you made. Totally, totally. One thing I'm concerned about always, though, is that I think we're in a bubble here, it seems like, and it's probably something for a different talk. We could do a whole talk about that. But we are in a bubble here, and we are in California, and we have access. We have a lot of access. And then in the Bronx, they have all these initiatives to, you know, get people access to this great food and the education about where the food comes from, the local, et cetera. What about people that don't have there? It's a really, really, I would say, the majority of the country that does not have access. How do we solve that?
Well, I actually don't 100% agree with you. From having traveled across the country now and been to a lot of these places that presumably don't have access, it's one of those things where when you drop in and start to see what's going on, you're really quite amazed. I mean, Arkansas on the Oklahoma border and seeing, you know, this, there's slow food movements even happening. Cody's in a part of Missouri where it's not fancy farmers. And they are starting to think about these issues. It really is starting to happen. I'm going to a town in Ohio, I can't even remember what it is, because they've asked me to come speak for their health initiative. It's it is many points of light, but it is really starting to translate into something that is not coastal at all. And you know what's really interesting for me is that when I give this kind of talk in a community where, you know, that's thought to, you know, be a community of need or to have a lot of representatives from that, none of them ever ask about these food issues or raise the topic of these food issues being an elite topic. I only get that question in San Francisco, where we have this sense of entitlement. There, it's just a matter of taking whatever sparks are there to grow those beautiful tomatoes and, you know, turning it on harder, you know. And they understand that it's not, a fight against Monsanto in a way. They understand better that it's a matter of just ignoring Monsanto and really starting a whole parallel system, an alternative universe with these farms.
What about food deserts then?
So the Bronx that I showed you, that is considered a food desert. And parts of Philadelphia that have the same thing going on, they're considered a food desert. And if you were to talk to Karen Washington, she would very much object to that term. Because she would say a food desert, by definition, is a place that has a big supermarket within 2 miles. And we don't have a big fancy Whole Foods here. We don't have a big fancy Safeway. But this is our food that we are generating. It's actually better. And so we are not a food desert. Please don't call me a food desert. And so that is that term is almost been used from above as a descriptor and a demographic. And communities are disowning that term. Because what, in fact, they are developing are healthy food systems that are not necessarily tied to Safeway or Walmart or what have you. I mean, Michelle Obama's, Let's Move campaign and her goal to bring healthy foods to communities involved signing contracts with Walmart, you know, to bring them into these neighborhoods. And a lot of the community members, I don't know if you follow what happened with Fresh and Final in the Bronx, where they said, that is not our Fresh and Easy in the Bronx, where they said, no, that is, we don't want that supermarket. You think you're fixing a food desert. What you're doing is you're going to, you know, bring a chain into our neighborhood that's going to change the biodiversity of our local system. It's a really interesting article in the New York Times about it, if you want to.
Hi, how do you effectively communicate to someone that you feel could really benefit from this way of eating in a way that doesn't turn them off? But
did I just turn you off? I'm sorry.
No, I get so excited about it, and I just had a friend visiting from town, and she was, she's looking for facts. Like, Karen, why should I make this choice and pay $8 for a carton of eggs when I'm going on and on?
Well, if she had come to this talk, do you think that story about the two farms would have compelled her?
I think it would have compelled her, but I don't feel that it would, because I told her about it, I've read the book, but what is it that's going to get someone to actually buy the eggs?
Well, they are buying the eggs. And, actually, you do have $8, but you might have $8 for 3 cartons of eggs, or $8 for 1 carton of eggs.
And that,
mm-hmm. And what I tell my patients is spend the $8 on that 1 carton of eggs, get a more delicious egg, get more nutrients, and probably get slightly lower cholesterol levels. And spend the, much less on some grains and vegetables and so on, things that have a much lower price point. It really, especially when it comes to animal products, less is more if you are getting stuff that has eaten well itself in terms of your personal health. So that would probably be the way that I would explain it. It's not $8 per carton. It's, what do you want to spend your $8 on in terms of health?
Yeah, I have a question. Why did you choose the intertwined carrot as the cover art for your book?
Well, if you squint, what does it look like? Looks like those medicine poles, So that was, part of it. But I also am really interested in funny-looking vegetables. And if you're curious to know why, I have a piece coming out in the Washington Post in a week or two on funny-looking vegetables and their connection to health. So that will be a cliffhanger for you. You can look for it there, okay? Thank you so much. This was such a pleasure. I appreciate you all coming.
Our thanks to Dr. Daphne Miller. And this program, the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year, is adjourned.